This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, September 29th, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. Members of Congress would like many lower-income Americans to save more, but some of that new savings would be subsidized by every other taxpayer. That's just one element being pondered in what's termed the EARN Act in Congress. Cato's Romina Baccia discusses what else is in there. There are numerous retirement accounts that you can get. One through an employer, you can get a 401k, a 403b. You can, on your own, get an IRA. The health savings account is perhaps the best retirement savings vehicle out there. What does the EARN Act do with respect to retirement savings and encouraging people to do it?
Caleb, I wish this was an easy question to answer, but the EARN Act has become so convoluted and packed full of a variety of provisions that it's hard for me to say just one thing. It makes a number of changes to retirement accounts, particularly 401ks and the nonprofit alternative 403bs. One of the things it does that will be helpful for many older Americans is to increase the retirement account contributions that Americans age 60 to 63 are allowed to make, up to $10,000 from a current $6,000 limit. It also allows for delaying required distributions, which means that individuals can keep their money in retirement accounts longer if they don't need to withdraw it immediately. It moves that age from 72 to 75. But there's also a variety of provisions that make the retirement system more complex, especially for employers in order to qualify for tax credits to set up a 401k account, which can be quite costly because of the complexity of rules and the sheer number of regulations. It requires employers to include more individuals that work on a part-time basis or haven't been with employers as long, which might deter some of these employers from setting up these accounts in the first place because it imposes higher benefit costs on them. Then there's also a number of provisions that, frankly, don't belong in this bill, like the ABLE Act. That was a bill that was adopted by Congress in 2014 with the primary intention of circumventing asset tests for federal means-tested programs, especially Medicaid and the Supplemental Security Income Program. So it would take the ABLE Act, which allows for accounts currently only for individuals who are 26 and younger, and would significantly expand the eligible population by raising that age to 46. And that means that many, many more people, according to a congressional press release, more than 6 million additional individuals would be eligible for setting up these ABLE accounts where they can shield assets from asset tests for Medicaid and Social Security, the Supplemental Security Income Program, which is the welfare portion of Social Security. So what does this mean? It means that, first of all, these programs that are means tested and asset tested are becoming more attractive to individuals that might otherwise continue to work, because if you can shield more of your assets from these programs and still receive benefits, why wouldn't you? With ABLE accounts, you can shield up to $100,000 in assets and still qualify for the Supplemental Security Income Program. Again, that is a welfare program for individuals with disabilities and older individuals. You can have unlimited assets in an ABLE account and still qualify for Medicaid, which is also a means-tested program that's supposed to be intended for individuals who need support from taxpayers the most.
And so some of this seems to be aimed at expanding those programs.
Yes, yes. And I think what's happened here is, having followed this retirement bill in various iterations since at least 2019, the different lobbying groups, I like to refer to them as the bootleggers and the Baptists in this case. The bootleggers, I'm thinking here of the financial service firms that have a lot to gain from making the retirement system more complex and expanding access for a number of individuals. And then the Baptists, I'm thinking of progressive welfare advocates in particular. the folks shepherding this bill through Congress have done a tremendous job of getting a variety of different provisions as part of this package, some related, some not so related, in order to gain broad bipartisan support. But it comes at a price. It comes at a price for taxpayers. It means various ways of expanding the welfare state and potentially increasing cost in some of those ways. Let me just give you one example. There's a provision in the Senate EARN Act that would allow employers to make 401k matching contributions for employees who don't contribute to their 401k, but who instead make payments on their student loans. So that is a way for employers to basically attract talent by saying, hey, if you have student loans you need to pay down, maybe you're not able to contribute to your 401k at this time. We don't want you to lose out on the benefit match that we provide to other employees who are contributing to their 401k. So we'll count your student loan payment in exchange, and we'll still give you that match in your 401k. That sets up an indirect subsidy for higher education. And what do we know about subsidies for higher education? Is that they drive up tuition costs. So on the one hand, there's a benefit, but on the other hand, if it increases the cost of tuition in the long run, that benefit may very well be a wash, or those employees might actually find themselves worse off.
I wonder, though, there are a lot of tax benefits that you and I would receive for contributing to a 401k, at least a traditional 401k, that is, that reduces your adjusted gross income, and that lowers your tax rate. And so is it proper to view that as a subsidy?
It isn't quite the same, because what that tries to correct for is the double taxation on savings. So income that you, when you first earn the income, is taxed as income. Then when you put it into a savings account and those savings grow over time, then you once again have to pay taxes on that capital gain. And so the entire retirement system with 401ks, 403bs, et cetera, was set up to fix that issue of the double taxation on savings, but only in specific contexts, in this case for retirement. The problem is that we shouldn't be taxing the gains from savings at all, because it actually discourages savings, which reduces capital formation, which means that we have a smaller economy that doesn't grow as fast, because there's incentives built into the current tax system for consuming your income immediately rather than saving it. So lawmakers have carved out certain provisions, primarily for retirement, but also for health savings, to correct that issue. But they've done so in a way that's highly complex and that ultimately benefits financial service firms and benefit consultants more than the individuals for whom these programs are intended. What would be far easier and simpler is if Congress just adopted universal savings accounts or removed the taxation on savings entirely, either one of those, to correct that issue so that individuals would save as much as they want based on their own consumption smoothing choices, what they think they want to consume today and what they think they will need in old age, without tax distortions in that system, or a universal savings account, even, let's start there. It's one small step that doesn't have all the strings attached that the retirement accounts do, including, say, the 10% penalty for early withdrawals, a variety of loopholes if you want to borrow money for certain qualified expenses before retirement. Let's just make it simple for people to save, period. We don't need all this complexity. It's not really helping. But that's not what we're seeing with the EARN Act. It doubles down on a system that is highly complex, and in some ways makes it more complex because it sets up a second tier of 401ks that employers will have to service. So now you have your traditional rules from before the Senate EARN Act, and then you have new rules adopted afterwards. So it creates more complexity in an attempt to encourage more savings among a variety of populations, but it does so in a very inelegant way.
You mentioned universal savings accounts. Of course, our colleague Chris Edwards has been championing those for years. They have yet to be adopted, but it's always in the mix of policy reforms. And if I understand you correctly, the primary beneficiaries of what the policies that are included in the EARN Act are benefits consultants, financial services firms that are essentially compliance-related firms, and advocates for expanding the welfare state.
Yes, that's what this bill looks like to me, because there are far simpler ways to allow for more easier tax-preferred savings for individuals than what this bill does. Yes, individuals will benefit as well, but I think one of the reasons that we haven't seen the universal savings accounts become enacted, but we're seeing so much support behind the EARN Act, is because which special interest group that can be well organized will actually benefit from universal savings accounts. I mean, it's basically the entire U.S. population, but that's not a special interest group. The public is generally not very organized when it comes to promoting their own interests in Congress. Instead, you see bills like the EARN Act moving forward because you have a clearly defined constituency, in this case, a mix of bootleggers and Baptists. The bootleggers here, I think, are financial service firms and other compliance officers, as you mentioned. And the Baptists here are progressives, welfare advocates, who have managed to include provisions that they care about, including a vast expansion of the so-called ABLE Act. What that does is it sets up accounts for individuals to be able to shield certain assets from means-tested welfare programs, in particular Medicaid and the Supplemental Security Income Program. Any funds in so-called ABLE accounts will not count against Medicaid eligibility at all. It doesn't matter the size of the funds in those accounts. And up to $100,000 in assets in ABLE accounts won't disqualify the beneficiary from supplemental security cash income, which is a welfare program intended for older Americans as well as individuals with disabilities. And the whole point behind asset tests is to ensure that taxpayer support only goes to those individuals who can't pay their own bills. And that only seems fair. And the ABLE account vastly expands eligibility for these programs for individuals who do have significant assets. And initially, when the ABLE Act passed in 2014, it was you had to have your onset of disability to qualify before age 26. The EARN Act would vastly expand that population by about 6 million Americans by increasing the age of eligibility to 46. Another provision that progressive welfare advocates have pushed for is to make the Savers Credit, which is a tax credit for certain lower and middle income individuals to encourage them to save for their own retirement, to make that tax credit refundable such that individuals who have no net tax liability will still benefit from the provision by just getting straight up cash from taxpayers. So how that works is that if a qualifying individual puts up to $2,000 a year into their 401k or 403b or IRA, they would get a direct match from the IRS for up to 50% of that, so up to $1,000 a year directly into their retirement account, whether they have a tax liability or not. And then they would also be able to withdraw that $1,000 every 3 years without having to repay it. So that's a way that those individuals could just straight up take that cash and spend it on whatever they so choose. So it's really, it's a handout for saving for retirement that's provided by taxpayers. And so you see that perfect combination of bootleggers and Baptists shepherding this these retirement bills, including the Senate EARN Act, through Congress, which look to have a high chance of passing in this fall's lame duck session.
Romina Bhatia directs budget and entitlement policy at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.